You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th, hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady, live only on Netflix.
Welcome to the Top Order Podcast. It's another cricketing Hall of Fame this week. This week we've got an Englishman, a couple of Australians, a South African walking into a bar, as well as a Pakistani. No, it's not a joke. It's the Top Order Podcast Hall of Fame episode, counting down numbers 70 through 66. Coming up soon. Bawdy, we start with a little bit of a bittersweet one this week. I'm going to hand straight over to you to tell us who's number 70 on our list of the Top Order Podcast Hall of Fame.
Yeah, evening chaps. A bit of a sad one, this one, actually. We didn't engineer this in any way, shape or form, but number 70 on the list is the recently passed away Alan Davidson. He's passed away this week, aged 92, surrounded by his family. So Vale Alan Davidson played 44 tests for Australia in the 1950s, 1960s. So just the 44 tests, but he did take 186 wickets in those 44 tests at an incredible average of 20.53. Strike rate of 62.2. He took two 10-wicket hauls in his career. Famously, that one of those was in the tied test in 1960-61 against the West Indies, where he also scored 100 runs in that test. We'll get to that. He scored 1,300 runs at an average of 24.59 with five half centuries in his career as well. Left arm, medium fast swing bowler for Australia alongside Keith Miller, Raid Lindwall in that period of Australian dominance as far as bowling's concerned in the 1950s.
Yeah, from an eye test perspective, I did watch a few videos of him. He's got that scary little hide the ball thing when he's running up, which scares me as a batsman. But the question I had, well, the stat that stands out to me is around his average. It's very low, in the low 20s, I believe, or 20 point something. I'll give that over to you, Baldy. I guess my question is, a lot of these, is average a stat that you can use, or does it hold any weight in the Hall of Fame? Because a lot of those low averages in the list of top 10, top 20s, are all for players who played 80 years ago or 100 years ago. How does that category or that stat hold any weight for you?
Yeah, average holds some weight, but Jared Kimber's interview with us on the Top Order Podcast unlocks the key to what we need to think about when we think about bowler averages, and that's average above replacement player. So what I've done in this Hall of Fame is put together the averages of bowlers in that player's career in that era to put it in some kind of perspective. So even though in terms of our Top Order Podcast Hall of Fame candidates, Alan Davidson's average is top three, when you put it in perspective, his average above replacement player slips down a little bit. It's about 15th, and that's because he's got one of the lowest comparable averages of his replacement player across any other players in that era. And you're absolutely right. Guys like Clary Grimmett, Jim Laker, Ray Lindwall, Richie Beno have very, very low comparative averages to compare their averages to. So they've got to be really, really good in comparison to some of their peers. On the other end of the scale, you've got a guy like Mitchell Johnson who has the highest possible, the highest comparative average of anyone who he's kind of being compared to. So, you know, his average is going to look pretty good, even though, you know, his average of I think it's 28, 29, something like that, it's not all that great. But compared to his peers, it's actually pretty reasonable. So Alan Davidson has an average of 20.53, so that's good enough for top three all time. But when you look at his average above replacement player, he's plus 7.51. Still good enough for 15th of all time and best amongst left-handers. He just edges out my comparison to Alan Davidson in the modern era, Wasim Akram. He's got an AARP ranked 16th in the Top Water Podcast Hall of Fame stats desk.
But Paulie, I've got a quick question before we kind of move on, and it is stats related. So I think you might have mentioned there, certainly in terms of peer comparison, the second lowest post-war average, I think, of people that met the Crick Info qualifying period. My question, though, is really around two things. It's where we got to on the sort of longevity piece. He didn't play that many test matches, comparative, particularly, I guess, to the modern era, 44. Mm. And also strike rate with the ball was, you know, relatively high. I kind of look at someone, and we do get a Kiwi into the five this week, albeit by a bit of a technicality. But just to go into bat for the New Zealand boys, someone like Shane Bond, who didn't play as many tests, only played the 18 test matches, but had a comparable average of 22, but a strike rate far lower than Alan Davidson's 62. How do we sort of, you know, balance up that sort of longevity and then kind of putting it in with some of the more modern stats that we might see and compare players?
Yeah, tough one. And this is where we get disagreement with from all corners of the cricketing world. Some people will value longevity and counting stats really, really highly. I am one of those people who places some emphasis on that. You still have to score the runs and take the wickets, even if you get an opportunity to play 100 tests, which is why Alan Davidson, even though he's got an average of 20.53, is down at 70 and not in the top 25. So there is something to be said for longevity. It's not Alan Davidson's fault that he only played 44 tests. He can't help that. But a guy who plays a lot of tests still gets an opportunity to make those runs, take those wickets, and they have to be able to do that. The thing that I look for in bowlers is definitely average, but also the ability to take big hauls of wickets. So, you know, those 5-wicket innings, those 10-wicket innings, and also the number of wickets he took per test. You know, he's well over 4 wickets a test there at 186 wickets in just 44 tests. So, you know, the not only did he do it at a great average, he did it by taking a lot of wickets per test as well, which is important to me from a stats point of view. And the fact that he was a good batter is also very, very helpful to an Australian cricket team that had quite a few all-rounders in that era.
Bully, you've led nicely in there in terms of the batting, because I want to touch on that. And I think we've run Alan Davidson through the ringer in terms of his stats, but I think it's incredibly worthwhile pointing out that he is a brilliant cricketer. I would love to listen to that Thai test stuff one day that you've talked about, because I think it's tremendous thinking about all of those. And, you know, thinking about those sort of, he's thought of as one of the great Aussie all-rounders, even though potentially, you know, you look at his batting average and it's only in the mid-20s really, from memory. But, you know, you think about around that time, they had Keith Miller, Davidson, Richie Beno, who were, you know, some of the best world all-rounders in the world. It made me start to think, why have Australia not developed more all-rounders? I mean, I can't really think of any great all-rounders that they've had since then, because most of their players, although they can kind of hold a bat or bowl a few overs, they've never really had genuine all-rounders, unless I'm just completely missing someone.
No, you're not. And Australia don't really encourage all-rounders in their national cricket setup. They haven't had to have an all-rounder for a little while. They had a reasonable bowling attack in the 90s, didn't really need a fifth bowling option too much. But I think they underbowled their batters who could bowl. They underbowled Steve Waugh. Alan Border underbowled himself. I think even guys like Shane Watson, due to injury, underbowled himself. You know, even thinking modern guys like Mitchell Marsh didn't really do a lot of bowling in their stint in the test side. So I think, if you have a look at those guys that Australia have got there, they've had a lot of bowling all-rounders. So I don't think Australia have really encouraged bowling all-rounders all that much. And I just don't think that it's been part of our game for a long period of time. England set up their test cricket team to have an all-rounder in that number six position. And until very, very recently, Australia haven't encouraged that. But it looks like we've got one in Cameron Green.
Well, that's a good place to wrap up Alan Davidson, I think. Let's move on. We've got a Kiwi in the list. Who are we going to talk about here? Dunedin born, but there's a twist, Baldy.
Yeah, Stuart's been hounding me week on week for a New Zealander to make it into the Top Water Podcast Hall of Fame. So I've procured one for him. Not only is he a New Zealander, but he's a New Zealand spin bowler, and he's one of the very, very best. Clary Grimmett, born in Dunedin, as you said, Adam, played test cricket in the pre-war era, 37 tests, 216 wickets in just 37 tests. at an average for a wrist spinner of 24.21 and a strike rate of 67.1. In just 37 tests, he took 7 10-wicket hauls and 21 5-wicket hauls, and that is just an incredible performance. The rate at which he took 10 wickets per match is third all-time. The rate at which he took 5 wickets per 100 innings is second all-time, and his average above replacement player also inside the top 25, average above replacement player of plus 5.97. Stuart, I'm going to open it up. I'm going to go to you because he is a spin bowler and he is a New Zealander. What are your thoughts on Clary Grimmett?
Oh, just smile on my face. I mean, even Binksy mentioning Shane Bond in the last one. Jeez, we're getting the New Zealand plugs out here. It's delightful. And there's no technicality here, Binksy, that he's a New Zealander. He's born in Dunedin, mate. He played Plunkett Shield for Wellington, I believe, at 17. So he's a born and bred Kiwi. Unfortunately, I guess New Zealand just didn't have the opportunities at that time that Australia did.
Yeah, that's the thing. He went to Australia looking for first class and international professional cricket, and he was able to get that playing in Australia for Australia. New Zealand obviously weren't a test playing nation. I think until the early 1930s, maybe. I don't quite have my stats to hand, but yeah. So that's why Clary Grimmett, having been born in New Zealand and played first class cricket in New Zealand before he became a naturalised Australian and lived his days in Adelaide, I believe.
And look, Bordy, I think it's probably unfair if I don't throw it back to you in terms of him being a leg spinner and a tremendous bowler. You mentioned the 216 wickets from 37 tests. I think that's seventh all time in terms of wickets per match. He's kind of well renowned for all of the variations that he brought to the game. I think he's known for developing the flipper. He practiced in his backyard with his dog, and his dog used to go and collect the ball, and he'd just sit there flicking his fingers and clicking his fingers, and he just, sounds like my kind of guy for sure. But Baldy, why is he not higher? I mean, he feels like he's had a huge impact on the game, and I guess we touched on it in the O'Reilly piece around that it sort of goes from Grimmett to O'Reilly and then Warne and McGill, and we've just seen this transition from, I'll call them Australian leg spinners. But it seems like he's had a huge impact on the game with what he's been able to do and even off the field afterwards.
Yeah, massive impact. I mean, he you're right, Stuart. He was widely credited with inventing the flipper. My favourite story here is that he had multiple variations, even on the flipper, and he was continuing to develop them after he retired from playing. He would work on his variations. The lovely little bit of the story that I really, really enjoyed is he disguised his flipper and the telltale click of the fingers by clicking the fingers on his left hand as he bowled his regular leg break. So he would bowl his leg break, and as he released it, would click the fingers of his left hand so that when he did it with the flipper, batters wouldn't be able to differentiate between the leg spinner and the flipper. I mean, that's next level disguise. That is absolutely superb.
So I've got another statistical question here for you, Baldy, so strap yourself in. When I had a look at his numbers, Clary Grimmett, he's clearly taking a lot of wickets, but when I look at his strike rate, that's quite high. It's in the low 60s. The good strike rates, over the history of the game are actually in the low 40s. So a strike rate of 60, 62 or whatever it is, it's not really that sexy. I guess, how does that compare to other spinners and how does he sit in terms of that strike rate metric?
Yeah, strike rate of 69 is not all that sexy for a spinner. I'm just going to bring up the stats here and have a look at best strike rates amongst spinners. Ravi Ashwin's right at the top. McGill and Murali at the top as well. Warney's up there, but Clary Grimmett's kind of middle of the pack in terms of those Hall of Fame candidates. So it's not the best, it's not the worst. It's around about the same as Anil Kumble, near enough as makes no difference. So there is an element of strike rate being important for a spinner. Spinners are asked to bowl a lot of overs, obviously, particularly in the second innings of a test match. So there is an element of bowling a lot of deliveries and having a little bit longer to work out your plans to batsmen. You can't just blast a guy out if you're a wrist spinner bowling 55 mile an hour. You've got to sort of think them out, and sometimes that takes 3, 4, 5, maybe even 10 overs to get that plan into action. So you would expect that those strike rates aren't going to be comparable to Bondi's kind of 41, 42. that does hurt him in comparison to some of those legend spinners like Ashwin, like Murali, like Warne, even Ranganaherath. So part of the reason that he's only at 70 and not in the, or 69 even, and not in the top 45 is that strike rate piece. It's also the fact that he's got, and I say only, 216 wickets from his 37 tests. So doesn't quite have some of the longevity as some of the other players do. But test for test, pound for pound, he is one of the best spinners of all time.
Yeah, Baldy, look, couldn't agree more. I tried to pick holes in your argument. The best I could come up with was the same as Raj, really. The strike rate wasn't there, and we got some guys with comparable strike rates that have come a little bit earlier in the list. Jim Laker sprang to mind, but when you look at, I think, the 6 wickets per game average versus some of his contemporaries and others in the Hall of Fame, it really does show a compelling set of stats. Interesting to know whether the click of the fingers with the flipper now would be deemed sort of simulation and outlawed from the game. I say it slightly flippantly. But yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see whether you'd get away with that now. Yeah, as a little bit of deception. But back in that day, you'd think that's a most excellent brinksmanship, wouldn't you? Let's move on, though, to the next one on the list. Who have we got sitting at number 68, Michael?
68 from South Africa, top order batsman, proving that nice guys can finish 68th in the Hall of Fame. It's Hashim Amla. 124 tests for Hashim Amla, 9,282 runs in test cricket at an average of 46.64. Higher score of 311 not out for South Africa. 28 hundreds in his career and 41 half centuries, an average above replacement player of plus 4.48, which is only 62nd of all time. That average also in the 60s, but 9,200 runs and 28 test tons for Hashim Amla.
Can I open up? Because I want to just ask here, when I think about Hashim Amla, it's really funny. I remember him in kind of the Dravid mold as a test player. I sort of think of him as kind of South Africa's version of Dravid, but then I had a look at his strike rate, because we obviously talked about Jeff Boycott and things, and his strike rate's almost 50 in test cricket, which is actually better than Nathan Astle, Jacques Callis, Martin Crowe, Javed Miendad. And then I thought about him as an ODI player, because he opened the batting, and his ODI strike rate's almost 90. His T20 strike rate is over 130. And then I watched some footage of him, and he had a ton of attacking shots, and I guess it just strikes me that, am I the only one who thought that?
So I did have a look at his stats, and I do remember him as a white ball cricketer. I remember him ticking off all those milestones fastest to this amount of runs. He did a lot of that throughout his career, and we're talking about the Test Cricket Hall of Fame here, and I'm thinking that he's that good that his best format of the game was actually white ball, which I found incredible. He also scored 2 IPL hundreds for CSK, which is incredible. Yeah, so I agree with you. I have that complete view of him. I guess when I think about Hashim Amla, I do think of that consistency, and I feel like the reason he was so consistent was that he had very few technical weaknesses, and mentally he was able to really assess pitches and how to bat on them. You saw that he batted differently depending on what kind of surface he was on. I saw some highlights from him batting in Australia in the white clothing, batting completely different to how he was batting in India with the white clothing on. So that's something that really makes him great for me. And I was actually, you know, surprised to see how far he fell away in his final 14 tests from a negative point of view, where he was averaging 30 in those last 2 years, which kind of takes away a little bit from his aura. But apart from that, he had great numbers, and I think he really led South Africa through a time of, I wouldn't say instability, but definitely inconsistency in terms of results.
Yeah, look, it's difficult to scoff at a guy with 9,000 test runs and 28 centuries, but I'm gonna. And for me, I guess it comes back to, look, the stats are an important part of this argument for sure, but it comes back to that sort of impact piece for me. And I just sort of look at someone that we've talked about relatively recently on the Hall of Fame, Kevin Peterson. So played slightly fewer tests, 104 test matches, but had a similar number of 50s and 100s over, I guess, a statistical analysis of those with 23 hundreds and 35 50s. And then actually a strike rate that would have got you out of the bar to watch in test match cricket, and impact on those games. So, look, Yeah, I guess for me, the first question on there, can Nice Guys finish 68th in the Hall of Fame? Well, they clearly can because he has. But on the eye test alone, look, I don't even think I'd have thought of him if I was putting together a list of, you know, the 100 players that that I would want to watch. But maybe that's the difference here, that that's 100 players that I'd want to watch rather than the labour of love that is the statistics behind this.
Baldy, where do the 2800s rank? Because I feel like that is the highest number we've heard for a while. Where does that actually put him in terms of your list?
Yeah, 15th all time. There's only 14 guys with more than 28 test hundreds. 29 is Bradman, and then you're starting to get into pretty elite company once you get past 29 test hundreds, all the way up to Tendulkar at the top with 51. So, you know, there are very, very few cricketers who got to 100 more frequently or more often than Hashim Amla did. So, you know, he has a very impressive test career. To your point, Adam, yeah, there are fancier test cricketers out there, but every cricket team needs the blue-collar guy who isn't flashy, doesn't, you know, yell, look at me, look at me, look at me. He just goes to work, gets on the keyboard, goes to the pressing machine, and goes about his job. You know, he does exactly what you ask him to do every single day. There's no fuss. There's no, you know, extra stuff about what he's got to do. He just goes in, does his job, goes home to his loved ones at night, or his cat, or whatever it happens to be. And that's who he is. And every cricket team needs a guy like that. For every Kevin Peterson that you've got, you need a Hashim Amla or a Rahul Dravid, because it's the pigeons that allow the peacocks to stand out in a cricket team. And every team needs a pigeon or two to allow the peacock to stand out and be beautiful. And Kevin Peterson was a big, beautiful peacock that stood out loud and proud and brash, but it needed a guy like Hashim Amla or someone similar to be just behind the scenes, making sure that everything happens. Maybe he's like the duck, you know, serene on the surface, but paddling away furiously under the water. I've run out of bird analogy, so I think we should wrap it up there.
Yeah, well, Baldy, look, I was going to argue with you, but I feel as if I might push you over the edge. So I think probably a good time to actually move on to the next one on the list. So number 67, who are we talking about?
67 on the list is a Pakistan batter who played 120 tests for his country. Again, up around the 9,000 runs mark. He has 8,830 runs at an average of 49.6 with 2,500s and 46 50s. We are, of course, talking about Inzamam Ul Haq, the bane of New Zealand life. And he's got an AIRP of plus 8.49, which is good for 32nd of all time. So a pretty good average above replacement player as well.
Yeah, I guess in my mind he was the poster boy for a lazy cricketer, wasn't he? That's what I remember of, and I feel like that's actually a bit unfair. I went back and I actually probably out of all the people we talked about today, I spent the most time looking at him, mainly because it reminded me of what I could have been. But he was generally in a great position when he was contacting the ball, and he looked really good. I told you I spent a lot of time on YouTube. I came across that video of him attacking a fan in the stands. I'm not sure if you guys have seen that, but I did some research into that, and that was allegedly because a fan had been comparing him to various kinds of potato for far too long over a megaphone, and he got a bit annoyed about it. But in all seriousness, the best stat I could find about him, which I think is actually incredible, is that he averaged 49 or over in seven different countries, which is an incredible stat when you actually think about that, including New Zealand, where that can be, you know, that's as far into his home conditions as possible. He averaged in the mid-50s, I believe. So, I think he was actually a great batsman and probably gets tarred with a brush that may not be fitting for him, I think.
Yeah, look, I can't really be reasonable here because I still probably haven't really got over what he did to New Zealand in the 92 World Cup, so I just can't really be impartial. And he just smashed us in the tests as well. So I think he averaged, I had a quick look because I remember him just getting runs and runs and runs. And yeah, he averaged 66 against New Zealand in tests, including his 329. And I thought, oh, well, I'll have a look at that scorecard. And then, so Pakistan scored 643 in the first innings, bowled New Zealand out for 73. And then, not surprisingly, we lost that game by an innings and quite a lot of runs. And, yeah, weird, weird sort of game. Shahid Afridi got a golden duck opening the batting for some reason. And Inzamam got... The person that dismissed Inzamam that day was Brooke Walker, if anyone listening to the podcast remembers him. So, yeah, one of the forgotten leg spinners of New Zealand cricket. But, yeah, I don't know what I can say about Inzamam. The interesting stat I did see in terms of, you know, Bully, you often talk about contributions to winning. So Inzamam averaged 78 in Pakistan wins and 28 in losses. So, look, I think that's got to be what you might know better, but that feels like one of the biggest disparities and just sort of a remarkable insight into, you know, how much of an impact he did have on winning for Pakistan.
Yeah, he was massively impactful as a player and a leader. I mean, Inzamam, over the course of his career, played for 10 different captains, including captaining the side himself for 31 tests. And that says something very positive, I think, about his leadership, that he managed to last 31 tests in an era of cricket in Pakistan where captains were being changed like underwear. I mean, only Wasim Akram captained the side for more than 20 tests during Inzamam's career. So, you know, kept that off. He had shining moments. He scored 100, a big daddy 100 in his 100th test, which was also a victory against India, I think, from memory. But he had 184 in his 100th test. Look, he was run out a lot in his test career. He wasn't a tremendous runner between wickets, but he was just a fantastic cricketer. And whenever he played Australia, I always felt like he was going to score runs against us. And I think everyone really felt like that.
Yeah, a little bit like Lippy. I have first memories of him in that 92 World Cup. So played a role in that semi-final. And then England, obviously, getting a little bit of heartbreak in the final against Pakistan at the MCG back in 1992. So those were definitely my first memories. The first thing that then springs to mind is the amount of times he got run out somewhat comically. So kind of had a quick look at that. 40 times he was run out in his one day international career. So there's a few bad calls in there, no doubt. But again, we talked about this on a previous edition, and I couldn't really remember too much about VVS Lakshman, just because he didn't particularly perform well against England. So, I didn't recall too many massive innings that he had, whereas Inzi was the opposite of that, had a really, really good record against England. So if I go back, I think, to actually a test series played in England shortly after that World Cup. It might have even been the 92 World Cup. 92 World Cup year that Pakistan then came to England for the English 92 summer. So memories of him scoring runs in England and actually played the seamers pretty well as well in England, which wasn't always the case for a lot of batsmen from Pakistan and India in those days. So, yeah, certainly a cracking player. And like Raj says, a man after my own heart, because a balanced diet to him, I think, was a cheeseburger in each hand, wasn't it? Baldy, we'll move on to the final instalment of this show, counting down from 70. And we've got someone very aptly placed at number 66.
Yeah, 66, top of the club, the captain of the first tier of the Top Order Podcast Hall of Fame. Number 66, no pun intended, is English number four batter Joe Root. Has so far played 107 tests, or slightly more than that now, actually, now that he's played a couple against India. But when I compiled these stats a little while ago, 107 tests, exactly 9,100 runs at an average of 50, and a higher score of 254, 2,200s, 50-50s, which is good enough for 12th all-time, can you believe? And an average above replacement player of plus 7.69. And he has a fifer in test cricket. I didn't know that. There you go. He has a fifer in test cricket. And just had an incredible 2021. Four hundreds. How many hundreds did he have in 2021 so far? It seems like every time he batted, he got 100. Jeepers creepers.
Six.
So there you go.
600.
And he could have seven or eight by the end of the summer. So, look, an incredible, incredible performance for Joe Root. I think he's tied now for most test hundreds in a calendar year for England. I think only Compton and maybe Cook. I can't remember who the other one is, but he's pretty close to most hundreds in a calendar year for England.
So, Baldy, whilst he's aptly placed at number 66 on this list, I think the fact you've gypped him out of one of his hard-earned test hundreds, 23 test hundreds rather than the 22, and you've also done him out of 158 runs as well. So I expect on next week's list, he might have popped up a few more places. So we might see him in the late 50s for Joe Root. But look, I think the biggest thing in my view around Joe Root, when I compare him to someone that there's a lot of comparison made with him for a number of reasons, not least they're from a similar part of England, and Joe Root would probably talk about this guy as one of his mentors in the game, Michael Vaughan. Michael Vaughan, not quite as good a player, and I think shown by the fact that I don't think he's going to appear in this list, but had a test average when he wasn't captain of 50, but that dropped down to 36 as captain, Michael Vaughan, whereas Joe Root's average is actually a tick better as captain than it is when he's not in the captaincy hot seat, which, you know, I really think is, you know, testament to. They talk about the Australian cricket captain being the second most important job in Australia, after the Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, obviously proving that wrong, because there's plenty of people that are more effective in their jobs outside of the Prime Minister currently in Australia. But this is a cricket, not politics podcast, so we'll move on from that pretty quickly. But look, jokes aside, I really do think that the pressure, particularly that international captains are put under now, has got to be worth something. And for a guy to have probably one of the best records as a test captain, 27 wins as a test captain for England, which I think is good enough for number one, if not certainly number two on the list of England captains. And that, you know, that's the thing that really shows that he's turned into a pretty decent leader as well.
Yeah, you guys are on me about the stats today. I missed one test and he scores 158 runs and all of a sudden I look like a bit of a goose. Of course, he does have 9,258 runs in tests now. I was only one test behind, and an extra century will throw that in there. And he is going up all the time. I think at the start of the year I had Joe Root somewhere in the 70s, and then he went to Sri Lanka and he climbed into the low 70s, and then he played India and then he went into the high 60s, and then he played England. He played India again at home, and he's in the mid-60s now at 66. I think the number there has got a bit of a pun to it, so no pun intended. I will move him, particularly if he scores runs against Australia in the Ashes. Average 47.79 as captain, and under Alistair Cook, average 52.8. And that average as captain is climbing all the time, as you say, Adam, because he did have a bit of a lean trot there for a little while as captain of that England cricket team, but he's come good, particularly in the last year, I think five or six hundreds in the last year or so, or calendar year 2021 anyway, Raj.
Yeah, I had a look at Joe Root's numbers and I thought, yeah, they're good. You know, he's almost at 10,000 runs, good average. But then you realise that he's actually only 30. He's only 30. He's got a long way to go in this back half of his career. And when you dive into sort of the year-by-year calculations, which we've kind of talked about already, but first thing you notice is that England play a hell of a lot of test matches. 2015 and 16, that Root had 58 innings just in those 2 years. But secondly, because of that, when you have a form slump, like we've talked about earlier, it really is accentuated. And you know, you've got people saying that he's no longer part of the big four and all those things, which I think is completely rubbish, because then he has a year like this year and he's scoring runs everywhere in all countries and all conditions and big hundreds too. I think, we've actually got a serious cricketer on our hands here, and he's going to shoot up the rankings before he retires. And I guess one thing for me that I'm going to keep an eye on is the number of hundreds he has, because we did mention that number 29, which is kind of a little gateway there or a benchmark. He was at 1700s before this season, and now, as we've mentioned, he's up to 23. So as that number starts to go up, it will need to go up, because he's likely to play over 160 tests in total before he's done. But I think that he's going to shoot up this list. Over to you, Binksy.
Yeah, Bordy, just one quick question on the stats here. And look, I was trying to do a bit of comparison, and naturally you go and look at the Kane, Virat, Smith comparison, because these guys have been talked about in those echelons as the top four batters. Conversion rates is the question, and Raj has alluded to it a little bit there. They're not too shabby now, 2300s versus 50-50s. You're comparing that to someone like Virat Kohli, who's actually an even split, bizarrely, 2700s, 50s. Do you mark a guy down for scoring so consistently in terms of the number of 50s he's got, or do you mark him down because of the conversion rate when you look at those stats in your little algorithm?
Yeah, you can see it both ways, can't you? I mean, a guy like Joe Root gets to 50 so often. He does the hard yards for England, particularly in that side where he didn't have a lot of batting around him a lot of the time. And so I give him actually a lot of credit for getting to 50 as often as he did. A lot of people will be harsh on Joe Root for that conversion rate, 2300s and 50-50s. You know, that's less than sort of a 1-to-2 ratio. But he's going to catch up. I mean, we've seen him this year. He's got 600s. In the calendar year 2021, but only the 150. And if he can keep cashing in anywhere close to that ratio. He's going to climb that list of hundreds, you know, reasonably quickly. There are very, very few cricketers. In fact, I'm just having a look at stats here, and you talk about Michael Vaughan. He had the same number of hundreds versus 50s as well, but there are only, of the guys who qualified to be considered for the Hall of Fame, there are only 16 bats that have got more hundreds or the same number of hundreds as they have 50. So that's a pretty rare achievement to be Virat Kohli like and have the same number of hundreds as 50s. But I'm expecting Joe Root to catch up that ratio. And to me, it's not an issue. It certainly doesn't hurt him from my Hall of Fame reckoning. But I know that it has been a criticism that's been levelled at him in the past, particularly when he's been compared to Kohli, Williamson, and Smith.
Boys, I know we're out of time pretty much on Joe Root, but you know, you guys mentioned it before there around that he could go so much higher on this list. My question that I just want a quick answer on for each of you is, have we just seen the peak of Joe Root? Like, is this year, which has been absolutely tremendous, is this his best year? Because if it's not, I think we're talking about him way higher on this list. If he's got another level to go, then he's going to go way higher on this list by the time he's done.
Lippy, it's a great question. And look, who knows whether he has a year as good as this year. And let's be honest as well, we've still got a couple of months of it to go. So if he can snag himself a score in Brisbane or Adelaide or even at the MCG, we're talking about this being a very, very good year, if not a great year. I don't know whether we'll see him repeat that because it is off the charts, particularly in terms of his conversion rates. What I do think is he can still get better. I think there's a shelf life for an England captain, and I wonder whether he's coming up to that after this Ashes, whether or not they win the Ashes or not. It's time for him to maybe sort of let someone else have a crack for the next cycle. But he loves the game so much that I see him sticking around. And he's not in the white ball squads at the moment. So he's got that benefit of someone like a Jimmy Anderson. As long as he's got the hunger to go on playing Test cricket, he could quite conceivably play for another 4 or 5 years. But, you know, that's a long, 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 long way away. We look at how early someone like Alistair Cook retired when he probably had a little bit of gas left in the tank from a physical perspective. But I would certainly hazard that Bordy might be sticking him a bit higher up this list by the time he finishes his career.
Yeah, I don't think we've seen the best of Joe Root. I think he's got a lot of runs this year. He scored a lot of hundreds. Despite the fact that he's got 600s, he's still averaging in that 66 area. I think he's got another season or another calendar year or two of averaging above 50 in that 60 range across a calendar year. So, look, if he plays a lot of tests, and England do play a lot of tests, I think that he's going to have at least one more year like this in the course of his career, because he's not quite at his peak yet in terms of batting. You know, that sort of Ponting era, 31 to 34, that was when Ponting was really in his pomp and where a lot of batters reached their physical and mental peak. So I would expect another couple of years of strong performances from Joe Root.
Yeah, I agree with the sentiments there from Baldy and Binksy. It's around sustaining it. Whether or not it's his peak, I'm not sure. But if he can sustain it for 2 or 3 years, scoring 400 or 500 a year, scoring 1,200 runs, that's going to send him into the stratosphere in terms of this list. So, yeah, it's about sustaining it for me, and I think he can do it.
Well, that just about wraps up this episode of the Hall of Fame. Bonus points for any listeners who can tell us the number of animal references in this particular episode. As we've discussed over the course of the last few weeks on the podcast, more and more short content coming up with regular releases. After this Hall of Fame, you will see another This Week in Cricket in your feeds. And our next long form segment is around the evolution of T20 cricket. So if you do have any comments on whether you like the evolution of T20 cricket, hate the evolution that's ruining our red ball game, if you listen to many a British journalist, then please pop a comment in our social media feed or send us an email, thetoporderpodcast@gmail.com, or jump on to the website where you can also see Baldy's labour of love evolving in the Hall of Fame. But for tonight, it's good night and God bless, and we'll see you soon. Good night.
Sports Social Podcast Network.